from the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Owen Gleiberman is my guest. The longtime film critic for Entertainment Weekly, Owen Gleiberman has written a memoir about his years at the magazine and everything else. It's called Movie Freak, My Life Watching Movies. Owen Gleiberman, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks very much, Gary.
You know, it's weird because you probably know my name is Gary. But other than that, you don't know anything about me. But I know so much about you.
Well, you probably do now.
Yeah, because I've read your book. And it must be a weird experience because your book, it's different than writing, you know, I read your work in Entertainment Weekly for years, but so I know a lot about the movies you love, but now I know so much about you. And when you tour the country and you're doing your book tour, is it weird that everybody knows all your deepest secrets? Was it strange?
Well, I'll tell you why it's not that weird to me. For one thing, I think that I had reached a certain age where I could write a book like this. I don't think I could have done it 15 years ago. I mean, I could have done it, but I don't think I would have been as comfortable in my own skin doing it. And maybe in some ways having passed through some of the experiences I talked about. But beyond that, I think where it's linked, writing a memoir like this, where I actually get pretty personal at some points, quite beyond just the idea of talking about movies and movie obsession, which is the central theme of the book. I think it's tied to what drew me to movie criticism in the first place, which is that in part I wanted to do it because I loved movies and had a deep fascination with the idea of trying to figure out how they worked and express how they worked. But beyond that, I always saw film criticism as a vehicle for personal expression. The person who first influenced me to want to do it, Pauline Kael, part of what was so exciting about her work is that you felt she expressed so much of who she was in her criticism. And in part because movies are, if you watch enough of them, they really seem to be about every subject under the sun, from, you know, love and romance to economics to crime, whatever. I mean, in a sense, movie criticism is your excuse to week by week go in and have your say on these kinds of subjects and really what you feel about a lot of things. So that's what drew me to it in the first place. When I started blogging in the late 2000s, I found that the personal expression dimension of that just even opened up to me further, and I liked it more and more. I enjoyed the writing even more because I was able to kind of say more that was directly pulled from my own experience. And so writing a memoir was just like taking that to the next level.
Well, you know, I've read a lot of biographies where the subject of the biography is revealed to be an asshole. But Movie Freak, My Life Watching Movies, Owen Gleiberman, it's the first autobiography in which the author calls the subject of the book an asshole. Do you think you know, I mean, do you think a person could know as much about you by reading your movie reviews and the movies you love and hate? I don't think that's true. I mean, now you reveal an additional layer of things about yourself that's...
Well, I'll tell you what I did in the book that I think, you know, maybe is a little bit unique, or at least, without making that sound like I'm patting myself on the back, what at least drew me to revealing certain things about myself in a way that I thought would be original and, you know, was something for me to kind of contribute to the culture, which is that I do, you know, chronicle certain moments of my jerky behavior in there. But I actually don't, I don't think that some of the things I describe are necessarily any worse or certainly any more extreme than the kinds of things that have been described in many memoirs about all sorts of bad behavior, all sorts of addictions. But one of the ways that our culture works, I think, is that we tend to have books that announce, okay, this is a memoir of sex addiction or drug addiction or something like that. And then the behavior can go on to be very extreme, and that's fine. And even as we are liberated enough to have these kinds of books, we also put them in boxes, in categories. I say up front in the book, what I kind of lead with is not that I say, hey, guess what, I was an a-hole. I say, no, I was actually kind of a dork. I was, you know, I'm of the species, geekus americanus. I was a film geek. I was this guy who was very shy and spent you know, so much of my life in the dark, watching movies, sometimes by myself. And part of what I was trying to say was that, yeah, I was a geek, a nerd, but we have these kinds of passions too. I mean, one of the things that drew me to movies in the first place, starting when in the late 60s, when my parents took me to drive-in movies in 1967, 68, I was 8 and 9 years old. I saw films like Rosemary's Baby and The Boston Strangler and found myself kind of powerfully attracted to that whole dark allure of what movies can be. I've always been sort of attracted to the dark side. And part of what I was trying to say in this book is that that kind of person, those kinds of passions, can exist within the basic sort of movie geek that I was. I was trying to create the portrait of sort of the inner life of a geek. And that's what I thought. That's why I was willing to talk about some episodes that were not so so admirable in my life, because I was trying to say, you know, geeks are like this too, and I thought that that might shed light in a way on the kind of person who becomes obsessed with movies and is a critic and so forth.
Well, I haven't said it, but I will say it now, that Movie Freak, My Life Watching Movies, is really a fabulous book. I really enjoyed reading it a lot, and I loved the way you wove your personal story into talking about the movies you loved and the movies you hated. And I related to a lot of it because, you know, I'm a movie freak also, and a freak in general. Let's talk a little bit about movies. I'd like to catch up with you since the book ends, you know, at a certain point. So, like, let's just talk for a second about the films of 2015. What you know, if you were still at Entertainment Weekly, what would have been your film of the year?
Well, I made a 10-best list, and my film of the year was Carol, the Todd Haynes film.
Mm-hmm. Who have you been a fan of since Superstar?
I haven't always loved his films. I didn't think Carol was as great a film as Far From Heaven, which I actually ended up picking as my greatest film of the decade. But I thought it was incredibly moving, incredibly well done. I thought it had the greatest scene of the year, the final scene when Rooney Mara goes back to that bar. And just in a sense, it really had a powerful old Hollywood dimension. And I just got swept up in it. So I love that, and I love the Mad Max film. I really thought it was kind of extraordinary. I thought that he, just as the Road Warrior had taken what the original Mad Max did and sort of then reinvented it and brought it to a new kind of world, that Fury Road did the same thing, you know, did it with just the speed and the sort of, I don't know, a 21st century vision that he brought to it. I had to see it a couple of times to fully appreciate it. The movie moves so fast that you almost have to learn how to watch it. And once I did, I just found it absolutely thrilling and kind of true to the whole spirit of that series.
It's so, not, you know, one, I mean, it's not one you've watched 40 times, though.
No, I haven't had a chance to. And, I talk about in the book how I went through a period, a long period, of just being addicted to certain movies. It started around the time of Michael Mann's Manhunter, the prequel to The Silence of the Lambs. I watched that over and over again, and then films like Boogie Nights, Natural Born Killers, films that I would just become completely addicted to and watched them over and over again. I played them like they were albums, in a way. And one of the ways that I keep expressing this in the book, it's sort of a metaphor, but sort of not, is that the desire I had from almost a young age was, this is the reason I think I became a critic, was it wasn't enough just to watch something. I wanted to kind of live inside it. I almost use a metaphor of consummation. I mean, there is a little bit of that aspect to it almost, that it's not enough just to watch something. You have to kind of fuse with it. And watching films over and over and over again was a way to fuse with them, writing about films, trying to get really just kind of look at their vital organs and crawl right inside their meanings in a way. That is what fueled me as a critic. And I acknowledge that it is a kind of, in a sense, it's a love of art, but it's also a kind of mad, obsessive pursuit that defined at least the way that I did it. I wrote this book because I wanted to take a deep dive into the psychology of all that and say, this is what movies are to me. This is what movie obsession is. Maybe this is what art obsession looks like in our time. I think we used to think of it as a lot more wholesome. Now maybe it has this almost slight pathological dimension. But I wanted to write about that in the book because I thought maybe this will speak to other people. Maybe there's a lot of movie freaks out there, a lot of people who become obsessed with this, almost to the point where it seems a little unhealthy, but at the same time, that's part of the glory of it. It's part of what makes it, I think, a religious experience, this idea that we give ourselves up to something, that certain movies or certain art forms or whatever can almost take us over. I think art, in many ways, in the 20th century, became a replacement for religion. My own take on things is that we've been suffering for a long time, maybe ever since the Industrial Revolution, at being a secular society. I don't really think we were put on earth to be secular beings, whatever religion you happen to have been raised with. I think we do have a thirst for something higher, and yet for a lot of people, that kind of disappeared. Organized religion lost its luster. I think the basic things that replaced religion in the last 100 years were popular art and drugs.
Yeah.
And I think that that kind of searching, questing quality is there in our pursuit of both of those things in a funny way. And my book is all about movies. There's a little bit of drugs in it. but my point, even in writing about the drugs, is that that was involved, that I have always been, you know, questing for this other thing, questing for a kind of connection that maybe I didn't feel because I came from a problematic family and stuff like that. I just wanted to fill in my whole story and say this, you know, this is the sort of witch's brew that creates a modern movie.
Well, you know, I think there are two kinds of film criticism. There's the type that is literature about the cinema, and then there's the type that is a consumer guide as to where you're going to spend your $15, whether you should go to this movie or not. And at Entertainment Weekly, I believe you wanted to be the former, the literary kind, but you were sort of at Entertainment Weekly, they have that letter grade, and they had to confine your reviews to a certain number of words. Was that a difficult thing for you?
Well, I think you described that whole situation and the sort of tension and drama that went on at Entertainment Weekly very well, but here's the way that I would put it. I think that there was sort of a paradox going on at Entertainment Weekly. It was conceived, at least in its abstract form, to be a consumer guide. And yet, the person who created the magazine, Jeff Jarvis, he looked for people who were real critics, who were critics who were trying to do, as you describe it, you know, that kind of more literary sort of criticism, criticism with a certain ambition beyond just a letter grade. And those of us who kind of came together to create Entertainment Weekly, I think from the beginning we made the magazine both at once. I've always felt that all criticism does have that consumer guide function. I mean, even Pauline Kael would sort of write about movies in that way. So it doesn't have to be one or the other. And with the letter grades at Entertainment Weekly, we were kind of roped into featuring that front and center. But what I decided from the beginning, people would ask me in the first couple of years of the magazine, well, have you changed your style at all? Because I came from the Boston Phoenix and Alternative Weekly, where my reviews ran on, and I really tried to make each one a deep dive into whatever movie I was doing. I always said, no, I didn't change my style at all. I had to change certain things in terms of making pieces shorter. You learn certain things about writing in a compact way. But sentence per sentence, I felt like I was the same writer. And I kind of made that my mission, my quest, partly for my own sanity. I knew this is why I had become a critic. I didn't want to stop doing it just because I was writing for a mainstream magazine. And I think me and other critics and other writers of all sorts who were at Entertainment Weekly, we actually had an ambition to make it a really good magazine. I think that we did. And I think that we kept real criticism alive in its pages. And then its readers started to go, yeah, you know, we like this. But that tension was always there. It was there in questions about how much space you would get. It was there, and I talk about a number of dramas that sort of played out this way in the book. It was there in terms of the issues of which movies would be a lead review or not, which movie you could really go to bat for or just have to do in a little box on page 3 of the section, and how those questions, you know, on the one hand, I recognize that, you know, in the grand scheme of things, a lot of those issues may look like, you know, white people problems 3.0. But in another sense, they were all issues that related to how much we value criticism as a culture. I felt like I was trying to, in my own small way, uphold the values of criticism in the culture. Now we enter a realm where, as everyone is observing all the time, there's a great deal of criticism on the web, some of it amateur, some of it professional, probably less and less of it being done by people who are really being paid for it or being paid much beyond what you could make at Starbucks. All of this kind of fuses together into this babble, this ocean of criticism that we have. And yet what I find is that the more criticism there is, the less there seems to be a true diversity of voices, the more we get a sameness to it, and maybe even a kind of echo chamber, elements of groupthink that I think are only reinforced by digital culture. You know, A.O. Scott has a book out about criticism where he makes many arguments that I completely agree with about why criticism is valuable, why it's the kind of sibling of art, and maybe why it can even be at its best an art form of its own. I agree with all of that 100%. I would say a difference between my book and his is that I also make the case that I think there's trouble in the land of criticism. I think criticism, as much as it has multiplied, it seems to have lost its individuality. And the only way it can have individuality is if a critic is writing about something in as completely, nakedly honest a way as you can. I don't think there's much of a slippery slope there. You're really either honest about it or you're dishonest, but if you slip away even 8 degrees from your own reactions, then you're just writing a criticism that tends a little more towards the generic, that's leaning towards the hoard, that's reinforcing what everybody else is kind of saying. So I think you kind of have to work to kind of keep yourself the individual that you are in criticism, and that's the kind of writing that I believed in. I tried to do it at Entertainment Weekly. I try to do it now. But I think it's slipping out of the culture because in some ways we are valuing criticism less as a culture. And maybe it's because we're starting to value popular art less. I'm not sure if that's true, but it could be true in the franchise era.
We're talking with film critic Owen Gleiberman. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Well, you know, the people who are, you know, out there at Amazon writing reviews, there's only two reasons to write a review. That is, if you really love this thing or you really hate this thing.
Right.
Whereas a critic like you is going to go to a movie and write about it, whether they loved it, hated it, or somewhere else, some other kind of realm. And that's, you know, kind of a lot more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think that whole idea that you're really exploring what these things are about, that's what drew me to it. That's what made me want to become a critic. I mean, why is, you know, the Mad Max movie a great movie? Is it just because it moves really fast? Is it just a great video game? Or does it express something in the culture, a certain nihilism, a certain hopelessness in a way that's out there? I think it kind of does, and in a way it's the critic's job to demonstrate exactly how a movie like that does that. I think Carol did the same thing. I found it was very much a movie of its time. I mean, it was set in 1952 or whatever, but I felt it was really a movie of the gay marriage era. It was the most passionate film I had ever seen that really expressed not just an anti-prejudicial message, but expressed the idea that a love like the two women had in that movie, it could not be actualized unless it was public. It was either something you were able to do in a public way, or it was not going to be quite real. And I felt that that movie really expressed, even though it was a period piece, the cutting edge of what has gone on in the change between the symbiosis between gay culture and mainstream American life that's been taking place over the last few years. So those are the levels that movies work in, which, you know, that I want to talk about when I write a review, as opposed to just saying, you know, go see it or don't, or even Cate Blanchett gives an Oscar-worthy performance.
Yeah.
And of course, what does that even mean? Because Leonardo DiCaprio won the Oscar and it wasn't even a very good performance. So
Completely overlooked. What if Carol had been released at the time that The Price of Salt was published? Then it would have really had kind of a crazy impact. What if it had been, Shirley MacLaine and Barbara Stanwyck?
Well, I think the answer to that is that if it had been, it just couldn't have been the movie that it was. I mean, it would have had to have been very much kind of censored and toned down.
Yeah.
Because, you know, movies just do reflect their time. I mean, that's one of the things that's so fascinating about writing about them. They're always barometers of their time. Every period piece is on some basic level about the time in which it was made. You know, Reds isn't about, you know, the 1920s, about 1982.
Right, right.
The Godfather is about a certain perception of the way that government and capitalism was working that really said a lot about the early 70s. So that's part of the critic's job, too, is to sort of explicate how movies reflect all that.
Well, you know, you bring up an interesting point. I was born just a few years before you. And those few years make a big difference in how you and I relate to things. Like the way I related to the Beatles was different than yours, or the 70s revolution in film or television. And now that you and I are, let's optimistically say, middle-aged, are you sure that you can accurately write opinions for people in their 20s? In other words, does your criticism, maybe you're too old to be a critic.
Well, I don't, you know, I still respond to the movies that are put out every day. But, you know, the way I would put it is it's less about age than almost a kind of marketing conundrum. For instance, I don't particularly like the Hunger Games films, and yet those movies have been, you know,
they're huge, right?
Seen and sort of celebrated the world over. So does that mean that I'm too old for them?
It's a generational thing?
Yeah, a generational thing. Or does it mean that actually they're really not very good, but they were big hits anyway?
I don't know. I showed my film students, I teach a film appreciation class, I showed my film students A Hard Day's Night, which, you know, I think is the greatest movie ever made. And they just look at it like, you know, they have no relationship to it. That's like it's in Swahili. They don't understand it.
I think there are certain movies that are like that, and then there are certain movies that younger audiences, even though the films might have been made decades before they were born, younger audiences will respond to. But, you know, sure, there's always a risk that, you know, maybe you're too old for this or that. But where I kind of stick to my guns and have a pretty good faith that, you know, my aesthetic is current, is that it's not like I hate all or don't respond to all current movies or all current movies that that appeal to young audiences. Not at all. It's something like The Hunger Games. It really gets into an issue I have about franchise movie culture, and where I really think it's become a problem, and it's becoming a bigger problem in terms of all these comic book movies, which is that I don't have a problem with movies about superheroes or that kind of popcorn material, but the franchises that are plotted out, where, you know, it's going to be a 5-part series or it's going to be part of some, you know, 12 movie flow chart that's going to involve 48 superhero characters kind of moving through them, I feel like these movies are becoming encyclopedias more than they are movies. And I think you can make an honest case that the problem with franchise culture is that after you've seen a couple of these episodes, there's nothing organically at stake in these movies. You know that the hero or heroine is going to survive, even if it seems to be a life or death situation, because there's 4 more films in the series. Mm-hmm. So what is really at stake? And I think looking at a Hunger Games sequel and saying, oh, look at how they dramatized that scene in the book, isn't that cool? Or, you know, that's not the same as really an exciting movie experience. So I think having the critique of franchise culture that I do, I think it's valid. It doesn't mean that I can't respond to a really good superhero movie. You know, for instance, when I saw Deadpool recently, I thought that was pretty good. That kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
But I think that I don't know how critics stay young. Maybe some of them do get too old. But at the same time, the view that says, well, if you didn't like that, or if you don't like the Hunger Games series, I didn't like the Lord of the Rings series either, as a matter of fact, and yeah. I grew up with Tolkien. That's the kind of view that says, you know, if you don't respond to that, it just means you're too old because the box office proves that people love these films. Well, you know, that's too easy. I mean, there's always been big hits that critics questioned. I think if we just use the box office as a criteria of value, then where that leads us is pretty obvious. It leads us to saying that, you know, Taco Bell is great food or whatever. It just leads to a kind of flattening out of everything where numbers dictate what quality is. And I just don't think that anybody really believes that. But I think that we have such a heavy marketing culture in the United States now that kind of thinking is starting to take over. Listen, it's the basis of Donald Trump's campaign.
Right.
I mean, ultimately, sure. You know, he has a lot of so-called ideas, but the spine of his campaign is to say, vote for me because I'm a winner, because a lot of people like me. And that's not something you can really argue against. But clearly, there's something wrong with that logic. And I think it's equally wrong, if maybe in a less important realm, when applied to movies. Sure, all these movies that come out are big hits. But I don't believe that makes them critic-proof. I believe all the more that when you have, whether it's The Hunger Games or a Will Ferrell comedy or the new Captain America film, when it goes out there, when you know it's going to be a big hit, that's when critics come in and say, all right, now let's look at what it is. Let's talk about what it is.
What was your opinion of Star Wars, The Force Awakens?
Well, I had a funny reaction to that. And in fact, it kind of illustrates, I think, exactly my point about why you want a critic with a movie like that. I'm somebody who, I haven't been a fan of the recent Star Wars films. I did think the first two were terrific, but I mean, the original two,
mm-hmm.
in 1977 and then The Empire Strikes Back. But I've never been a Star Wars groupie. I've just never been one of those people who kind of lives inside that fanboy world of it all. But I do love Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back. When I saw The Force Awakens, not going in there as a super fan, but hoping that J.J. Abrams, who I really like, could bring a little bit of the magic that those earlier two films had. Like a lot of people, I watched it and I got caught up, I thought it was well done, and I got caught up in the idea that, like, wow, he's doing it. He's taking us back. This really does kind of have the feeling of those first two films. It certainly did much more than
those other,
you know, horrible middle three.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet, so I came out and I was like, yeah, he did it. But then maybe about 4 or 5 days later, I started thinking about it. And I thought, well, you know, one of the reasons I felt that way is that the movie was such a self-conscious throwback. I mean, it was trying in almost every moment to evoke the original trilogy. And I thought to myself, well, that's exactly what the original trilogy didn't do. It wasn't trying to evoke anything. It just was. And in that sense, I don't think that J.J. Abrams fully succeeded in doing what he might have done, which is to make a Star Wars movie that, yes, honored the tradition of it, but also was something that just felt new. And, I mean, that's what George Lucas did back in 1977, and I think he could have done that a little more. I think having, you know, a hero or heroine who are, you know, a girl and an African-American, that's not new. That's just, to me, the corporately approved, politically correct version of new. It's sort of a token, bold choice. So, you know, after I sat with it a few days, I realized, yeah, it was a decent movie, but it wasn't better than that. And that a lot of the excitement that greeted it was a version of, I think, fans so wanting this movie to be great that they declared it great. I think The Force Awakens was the definition of got the job done. And, mm-hmm. and once again, it took me, even as a curmudgeon critic, it took me about 4 or 5 days to kind of come down from the marketing high and realize, yeah, that it was.
To recover your curmudgeonness.
Exactly.
We've been speaking with Owen Gleiberman, and his book is called Movie Freak, My Life Watching Movies. Owen Gleiberman, thank you so much for spending some time talking with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks, Gary. Thanks for everything you said about the book. And it's really been it's been fun talking to you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the show. Come back and see us again next week. And in the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Owen Gleiberman, his new book, Movie Freak, My Life Watching Movies. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.